the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Will O'Callaghan is back with us, but also with us now, Miguel Delaney, chief football writer with The Independent. Miguel, Manchester United fans blame the Glazers for an awful lot, and with good reason, but can they be blamed for the disastrous managership or head coachmanship of Ruben Amorim?
Well, I suppose ultimately they agreed a deal where the Jim Ratcliffe Ineos hierarchy are in charge of football, who are responsible for the Amorim decision. So really, I mean, look, in everything does ultimately go back to the Glazers. As regards the specifics of this decision, though, and I suppose what is so galling for United right now is it's just the same cycle repeating itself, even though a big mission statement of Jim Ratcliffe, once he secured his minority stake, was to break that cycle. And if you remember, he'd initially been like, there was a lot of, before he bought the stake, there was some criticism of the way the club had been run. There has been maybe less direct criticism of some of the decisions since. But this just looks like, well, I was going to say it's a lot of the same themes recurring, except I think some of this is actually specific to Ratcliffe's leadership himself and who he's put in charge. And a big reason for that is, look, there's obviously a lot of arguments that could have been made that Amorim should have been sacked. Some of them we've made on the show. I wouldn't exactly defend that. But this, I think the whole 14 months sums up a lot about what United are under Ratcliffe. And even if you stand back a bit, right, one of the reasons that Ratcliffe has gone now, it's not just football, because the football...
Amorim
are gone now. One of the football had improved a bit, especially from 6 months ago. They are just outside the Champions League places, and for recently in them, if it is again to be another season where there's five places. But it's been about this, and it is a very modern tension in football between how much power the head coach has and how much power the football executives have. And that's fine. And like, I thought it was very conspicuous on Sunday where Amorim was going on about being a manager rather than a head coach, given United's announcement when they appointed him was that he's a head coach. And this has become a very specific legal term. But equally, that all of this is a consequence of the structure that Ratcliffe wants to put in place, the club and power. But equally, that there's almost a contradiction in terms, and it points to the dysfunction at United, that one of the reasons that Amorim was appointed basically because Ratcliffe pretty much liked the cut of him. Like, obviously, he was a very fancy coach, but it was Ratcliffe did have a hand in that.
It was right, Ratcliffe.
Personality.
Miguel, he's made a number of bad calls, hasn't he? Because Dan Ashworth, he waited for ages to get him in for Newcastle, director of football. He was gone within months. Eric Ten Hag, they decided they wanted to get rid of him, and then they changed their mind on the basis of the FA Cup win, and then got rid of him a few months later. So this isn't a one-off in Ratcliffe. In fact, has Ratcliffe got any of its decisions in relation to personnel right so far?
Well, on that, there's been three big ones, and I would say they've all been wrong. Or they've all worked out badly or involved bad decision-making. As you say, Ten Hag, the decision to give him a new contract when they were essentially interviewing him for his own job, immediately that's absurd. The Dan Ashworth thing was a farce. All the more so, let's not forget, because it was Ashworth that actually cautioned against the appointment of Amorim. Numerous sources say that. And I don't think that's actually a reflection of Amorim as a coach. It's more, although a lot of people have a lot to say about that, there were always signs, I suppose, that he was wrong for this specific job, given the way he worked, given what he required, and maybe he was probably a coach that United should have appointed somewhere further down the line. But yeah, they went with him, and it hasn't worked out. It was the first big managerial appointment of the Ratcliffe era, and United are back at square one. So I think, while there's a big debate we could have about Amorim himself, I think more of this is reflective of United under Ratcliffe.
Well, Will O'Callaghan, just how bad was Amorim? Is he the worst Manchester United coach of the last 50 years?
I was going to say, I wasn't around in the 70s to see the post-Matt Busby era when they got relegated from the top flight of the English league.
Well, you had the likes of Wilf McGuinness, Frank O'Farrell, Tommy Doherty, everyone's through, Dave Sexton, Ron Atkinson, nobody could bring them back to where they were. They had a couple of cup wins, but not where they wanted to be in the league.
Is it worse than David Moyes?
Probably,
would be the question probably over the period they've had now. I'm thinking
statistically, yes.
Yeah, you could argue maybe that Amran got them to a Europa League final. You could argue that probably the position he's left them in now, as Miguel has said, is just outside the top five of the Premier League. There was a feeling that maybe they had turned a bit of a corner over the last six or seven games, but then when it felt like they
when you include results against the likes of West Ham, Wolves, Everton, Leeds.
And particularly the stylistic change for the Wolves game is problematic because it felt they were just getting into their groove with a 4-4 system in the Newcastle game, and then he decided to switch and go for three at the back against Wolves, and they put in a really poor performance. So there's no defending that. This guy said he's going to be remarkably rigid. He said not even the Pope could convince him to change his style of football, and Amran was going to stick by the way that he was appointed. And from the moment that he came in, he effectively said that he was backed by Jim Radcliffe and the rest of Ineos, that he could come in and put his style of play in place. And it is only a few months ago that Jim Radcliffe was doing a run of interviews and Manchester United lost to Grimsby, and he said this guy's going to need 3 years.
Yeah, it's an interesting point though, is there a Manchester United way of playing that you actually have to play almost a 4-4-2, that people expect, Manchester United fans expect wingers, they expect a certain class and quality, a style of play in the old tradition. Now, I know the game moves on.
Is some of that romanticised
system,
though, when you consider that Ferguson played a 4-5-1 in Europe and oftentimes went to a counter-attacking style, and coaches that he brought in like Carlos Queiroz oftentimes changed the style a little bit.
Now, he always had four at the back though, didn't he?
He did, but is there a bit of a class of 92, this idea of the United way though?
What do you think, Miguel?
So there's been a lot of debate, obviously, about whether United can play three at the back. And this could be relevant, given I've written today that their top target is Glasner, who's played that a lot with Palace. I know Paul Scholes, who can be very good on United issues. There were some clips around him recently talking about how United just don't play three at the back. I have to say, I just do not agree with that. I think it's in... It's an element of kind of magical thinking that has held the club back over the past 15 years a little bit, I'd say. Because like the issue with Amorim wasn't that he played three at the back. It was the way he played it. Like, three at the back, it's won the title. Like, Conte did it with Chelsea. Glasner just won the cup with it. It can work. It's just about the way it's implemented. And the issue here was basically just Amorim's dogmatic adherence to a specific type of back three. It wasn't back three itself. And even kind of like, you know, you can get very technical with this, but... That's sort of disproved by the reality that, I mean, lots of teams that play like four at the back, when they're attacking, that actually becomes three at the back because the defensive midfielder drops into in between the centre halves. The centre halves spread out and the full-back go and play as wingers. You see that a lot with Pep Guardiola, and that's sort of a three. I mean, modern football, I think, it's way too fluid.
Miguel, could it be that he was let down by the hierarchy, particularly in relation to the purchase of players, and that, or maybe it's a chicken and egg here, maybe should he have adapted the team to play in a different way to suit the players that he have? Or was he let down by the failure of Manchester United to buy in particularly the types of centre and midfielders that he needed to play that game effectively, rather than depending on the rather one-paced aging Casemiro and the likes of Ugarte?
Well, there is an argument that if you're a top club who wants to just go out and win now, you do have to go out and pay the premium and that sort of player. I mean, even Liverpool have been so kind of like the term has been moneyball about their approach. They have made big signings in that regard. Chelsea, for all the criticism and all the kind of turnover players, they did go out and spend $250 million on their midfield. And it's obviously essential to an Amorim system. I suppose the bigger issue is, if you need to spend $500 million to make your system work, well, what's the point of appointing a manager then?
Well, indeed.
Really, that just comes down to recruitment. And that is where I think it's a little bit of both. I think, because look... Again, United knew what they were getting. It was Amorim had always been clear about this. He wanted to play a certain way, and he needed the players to do it. He didn't get those players. Now, he might have got them in the medium to long term, which I suppose where I think there's a specific tension right now, because he wanted signings this January that United weren't willing to make. And I suppose, but even to be fair, the latter point, I think that's a little bit clouded by how the relationship was starting to deteriorate. And from what I'm told, the Wolves game ended up representing a massive shift, the 1-1 draw at home, and that was kind of basically nadir. Like, as I said, I think from what I'm told, they had a meeting on New Year's Day on a Thursday where Amorim was a big topic of discussion. Obviously, there was a blow, as has been widely reported now, there was a blow-up between Wilcox and Amorim on Friday, and pretty much the decision was made. But yeah, like I think concerns about the approach naturally affected recruitment as well.
Okay, but well, recruitment doesn't solve everything. You think Nottingham Forest have spent about 150 million quid on strikers, have only got a few goals between them, and they're now in a relegation fight. And Chelsea, as Miguel has referred to, keep spending money and never seem to be happy with what they've got, and are also in a sort of a Manchester United position in the league. And they're also without a coach because Maresca has got the bullet.
Yeah, well, look, Chelsea might argue that this system has worked for a quarter of a century now at this stage, that they'll just bring in more players and somehow it works out. It seems they just want to buy wingers at this stage, though, which was part of the problem with the way their team were set up. Obviously, the Maresca situation is slightly different in that he went to talk to Man City and he went to talk to Juventus. That annoyed the Chelsea hierarchy, and a bit like Amrum, I think the minute that Maresca was talking about that and this terrible 48 hours where he felt that he wasn't backed by the club, the decision was always likely to be that Maresca would leave. It's interesting they had a clause within his contract as well as part of this, which felt like they didn't ever have full faith in Maresca as their head coach. It's weird as well, the week that was in it, that it cast some doubt over whether Pep Guardiola is going to be there beyond the end of this season at Manchester City, because we know his contract ends in 2027. I think we can only read between the lines that the conversations between City and Maresca were about potentially succeeding Pep Guardiola, which would have been 27. Why are you talking to him now while you're both in employment? It doesn't seem to make much sense, unless they have a feeling that Guardiola is going to leave maybe at the end of the World Cup this summer.
Yeah, because he wouldn't want to be a lame duck in his last year of his contract, perhaps. That's possible. What about successors to Amrun at Manchester United? Will they go for a full-time appointment now, or could it be they won't be able to get the person they need? One listener suggesting they should go for Carlo Ancelotti as an interim, perhaps. Could it be somebody internally, or could they go for a Kieran McKenna from Ipswich as a full-time appointment, or is it going to have to be a bigger name? What's going to happen, Miguel?
So it'll be Fletcher this weekend, as we know. From what I'm told, they would like Carrick or a similar figure to take them to the end of the season.
He's available, isn't he? He's out of work since he left Middlesbrough.
Yeah, exactly. And he did an okay job in his last spell as an interim at United. Another recurring pattern there. It must be said, they do have a lot of former players to fall back on as standing coaches, unlike, say, Liverpool, if that comes to pass. But I think... it's not definite, but right now, a permanent appointment looks much likelier in the summer. Because I suppose they would probably also feel that they made a mistake appointing Amrun mid-season as well. It did end up kind of causing a lot of unnecessary problems. And if it is the summer right now, the top target is Glasner. That could change, of course.
Despite the fact that he favours the 3-4-3, which didn't work for Amrun, or is he more flexible in his use of 3-4-3?
So Glasner is much more flexible. I mean, and even he wouldn't even say that he's on record about this in the passing. He doesn't necessarily think of himself as a three-man backline manager. It's just what worked for a certain system. And there is an argument, I suppose, both for Manchester United as they are, and football as it's evolving, because we've discussed on the show before that we're kind of moving out of this dogmatic era, that it makes sense actually to have a bit more adaptability in that way. Maybe the bigger question with Glasner is it's this vintage one that it comes to kind of any coach taking a step up, and it was true of Amrun as well. A, whether he plays an approach that's suited to being a club of United's resources, especially as regards possession football. And B, I suppose, just the pressure, the weight that comes with Manchester United, especially because the more managers that are appointed that don't succeed, it's like the greater that pressure is, the greater the weight is. But I have to say, Glasner feels like the sort of personality that can withstand it.
And then it's Celtic as well today, Will. We also had the managerial change. Another manager who absolutely Pope-like had to stick with 3-4-3 has lasted about two-thirds of a Brian Clough.
Yeah, I mean, this is a particularly messy one for the Celtic board, because there were many voices who were saying, Martin O'Neill, while the football has not been good in this eight-game period, Celtic were winning games and were finding a way to win. And particularly, I know we talked about it a few weeks ago, they had a period which they had a couple of European games, the League Cup final, and Rangers on the horizon. And the feeling was, why would you not leave Martin O'Neill in charge probably until the new year, try and keep the results going, take your time about getting your appointment and then bring someone in for the second half of the season. Instead, they felt that they had to chase Wilfred Nancy. Everyone is now going to look back at him buying tactics boards online and his online history, which is left behind him. This kind of farcical run that's been there, losing 6 of the 8 games with a small reprieve in the middle of it, but really quite a few embarrassing results. And I think the enduring image will probably be as well on the pitch. Half of the stands being empty for the game against Rangers at the weekend. They went 1-0 up, but then Rangers went through them so easily. And that was the problem. Even the two games that Celtic won, teams were playing through them far too easily under Wilfred Nancy. So from his point of view, I think there was no way back, despite the impassioned speech that he gave at the tail end of last week at his press conference, where for 7 minutes he argued, this is why the Celtic board have to stick with me. And now I would be shocked if it was anyone else but Martin O'Neill that ends up going in until the end of the season. And they would have to say to the Celtic board that this is entirely on them because of the way they've approached the season.
But doesn't it also emphasise, Miguel, just how far behind other international leagues the Scottish Premier League has now fallen?
Yeah, I mean, but like, I mean, this is a very, it's a widespread problem across European football now. And it like, again, it's something you can get quite technical in, but this really comes down to the size of your TV market. And it's especially against a kind of a behemoth like the Premier League. If you're from a kind of a small to middle-sized country, the TV market basically isn't big enough to sustain the sort of wealth that would make these clubs. I mean, like Celtic are a historically massive club. They're in a big European city. It's quite ironic, really. If a wider European Super League existed that Celtic were in, they could feasibly grow to a giant again that could actually compete. But as it is, they're in a small league that just can't sustain the sort of wealth that a club like Celtic need to actually challenge a Champions League level, given they are former European Cup winners. But I think that's a lot bigger discussion than actually Scottish football.
Overall, from the Christmas and New Year period while we were off air, well, it's been very good for Arsenal, hasn't it? And that last-minute equaliser for Chelsea yesterday at Manchester City must have put a lot of smiles on a lot of Arsenal fans' faces.
I would say so. Maybe they thought, well, the caretaker in charge, Man City, it appeared to turn around their form. They weren't expecting a whole lot of Chelsea at the Etihad yesterday, but I felt Chelsea were pretty good value for the point at the end of the game. Again, it's a Chelsea goal that's come from across to the back post, which has become very much their move this season. Arsenal themselves obviously getting that win against Bournemouth at the weekend, and perhaps more crucially, the win in the middle of last week in that twilight zone between Christmas and the New Year, where they managed to beat Aston Villa, who, you know, are the team who are keeping on their coattails as much as Manchester City. Unai Emery continued to say, we're not in a title race, but the reality is at the end of this weekend.
Yeah, but the 4-1 defeat at Arsenal last week was pretty significant.
Yeah, and I think sometimes this is where it catches up with a team. Aston Villa were overperforming, I think, their performances on points, and then they went to an Arsenal team who hadn't been totally clinical the 2 weeks previously, but then they scored all the goals. I can't see anyone reeling in their 6 points from here.
What do you think, Miguel, in less than a minute, please?
Yeah, I have to say, I've felt since the start of the season that Arsenal win it, mostly due to their depth. I think the biggest challenge for them is actually if City get within sight of them, whether Arsenal's own angst and doubt, having not won a title for 21 years, starts to affect them. But that's already happened a few times this season, and they have played through it to the point they're 6 points clear now. I think.
When do they meet in the league?
It's in April.
April, and so, who's at home in that?
And that's at City. There was a 1-1 draw at Arsenal in September, which Arsenal, actually, that was a game where Guardiola played Mourinho tactics.
That's right. But I suppose basically, so what Guardiola has to do is just keep City in touch with Arsenal until that big game in April.
That's essentially it. But City are starting to endure injury problems now. Look at Guardiola yesterday. And I think this is going to be the massive advantage for Arsenal, especially in like January is going to be a really busy month. And Arteta almost has a full squad back with at least 2 players for every position. Okay. And I think that's going to tell the real difference.
Thank you very much. Miguel Delaney, chief football writer of The Independent, and Will O'Callaghan from Off the Ball.
The last word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.